Thanks very much, August, and good day, everybody. Welcome to this Council on Foreign Relations virtual roundtable on the prospects for peace in Afghanistan. For those of you who don't know me, I'm senior fellow here at the Council and director of its Center for Preventive Action. I think to say that the current peace process in Afghanistan is facing formidable challenges at the moment would be a gross understatement. In recent weeks, the initial agreement between the United States and representatives of the Taliban that was signed in Doha in late February, and in particular its provisions to suppress or dampen the level of violence in Afghanistan, has come under intense pressure as a result of a major uptick, frankly, in violence in Afghanistan. And I think, in addition to the fact that the crucial inter-Afghan talks that were a part of this agreement have yet to commence, and we're also seeing, obviously, increasing friction and animosity, frankly, between the major powers, which will be crucial, I think, for any peace deal in Afghanistan sticking. That is also been deteriorating. So I think it's fair to say that the prospects for a good outcome here are looking very doubtful at the moment, but we remain optimistic, and I think we have a terrific set of panelists today to talk through these issues. First, Seth Jones, who holds the Harold Brown Chair at the Center for Strategic and International Studies here in Washington, D.C., where he is also director of the Transnational Threats Project. Seth has written extensively on Afghanistan, visited there many times, and he has written most recently a terrific report for us in our Contingency Planning Memorandum series on a failed Afghan peace deal and how we can prevent that. He is joined by Laurel Miller. She is Program Director for Asia at the International Crisis Group, also here in Washington. She too has a long interest and involvement in Afghanistan, including serving most recently as acting special representative for Afghanistan and Pakistan at the State Department during the Obama administration. So the plan today is what we typically do is to engage in some initial discussion between the three of us, and then we will open it up for Q&A from the members on the call. Just a reminder, this discussion is on the record. So let me start with you first, Seth. Just as sort of by way of background to get us up to speed, how did we get to where we are today? What's the current status of the intra-Afghan discussions?
Thanks, Paul, for the question. And let me, before answering, just thank you and the council for hosting this. And it's really an honor to be doing this with Laurel Miller, who I have gone back and forth on Afghanistan a lot over the last number of years. And she's an outstanding expert. So how did we get here? Well, most recently, at least in 2020, on February 29th, 2020, which incidentally turns out to be 2 days after the alleged presidential daily brief that highlighted GRU assistance to the Taliban. The U.S. and the Taliban signed an agreement which was intended to be a first step towards an intra-Afghan peace deal. As part of that agreement, this was simply the U.S. and the Taliban reaching an agreement. Key provisions of that agreement included a U.S. commitment to eventually withdraw all U.S. and foreign troops from Afghanistan, a Taliban pledge to prevent al-Qaeda and other terrorist groups from using Afghan territory to threaten the U.S. and its partners, and a promise by both sides moving forward to support intra-Afghan peace negotiations. So after the agreement, the U.S. agrees to go down to from about 14,000 troops to 8,600 to proportionally reduce the number of international forces, and then to start working on reducing prisoners and having prisoner swaps. Fast forward to July of 2020, the negotiations were supposed to have started in March. They haven't. They've been bogged down by discussions about prisoner swaps. My most recent numbers have The Afghan government releasing about 4,000 of the 5,000 promised Taliban prisoners, the Taliban releasing about 770 or so of the 1,000 promised Afghan prisoners. But a lot of concern also about the rise in violence, including Taliban attacks. Earlier this month, the Taliban conducted a pretty serious attack at an Afghan intelligence and NDS facility in Samangan province. According to some estimates, violence levels are up about 20% from levels around this time last year. For those who may have missed it, there looks like there were border clashes over the last 24 hours on the Afghan-Pakistan border in Kunar, including Pakistan Army firing at Afghan bases. So there's been a lot of back and forth, even at that level. Zalmay Khalilzad, who's the lead U.S. negotiator, has certainly been busy. He's been in Doha. He's been in Pakistan. He was recently in Tashkent to meet with Central Asian foreign ministers. There have been a lot of discussions about foreign development after a peace process. He's met with Mullah Baradar, but what we haven't had yet is the start of serious intra-Afghan discussions. And there are a whole range of reasons for that, which I think Laurel can get into. So back to you, Paul.
Okay, so picking up where you left off there in terms of the status of the intra-Afghan negotiations, Laurel, if you could give us a sense of what are the principal challenges here, the obstacles, sticking points, what have you, and so we get a better idea of really what has to be done to make this work.
Sure. I think there are two primary sets of issues. One is, what are the proximate obstacles to even getting an Afghan peace process going? And then there's the question of, what are the obstacles to having a successful peace process if in fact you get it going? Seth alluded to some of the obstacles in getting it started. Again, that the talks were supposed to start on March 10th, and the most consequential blockage has been over these prisoner exchanges. And what it has come down to is not so much the numbers, which can get up to the numbers that were agreed, but a question of a few hundred prisoners that the Taliban says they had understood they could determine who gets released, and the other side says, no, there are a few hundred on your list who we don't want to see released. I think it's important to recognize, stepping back from this immediate dispute, that the U.S.-Taliban agreement also calls for all of the rest of the prisoners, I stress, to be released in phases pretty early on in a peace process once they start. So this current debate over prisoner releases is only about the first tranche that was supposed to occur before the talks start. Even if you get over this obstacle, you're not done with even this particular problem, much less the much more substantial ones. There's been a lot of debate and discussion also over where would the talks happen, how would they be conducted, would there be any international neutral facilitator or not. There are some tentative understandings on these points, but not very firmed up as yet, which suggests that even if the process gets going, it's going to be pretty messy just from a purely process perspective in its early stages. There's agreement that the talks would start in Doha. The Qataris would like the talks, once they start in Doha, to stay in Doha. But both Afghan sides, the Republic side, let's say, and the Taliban side, prefer that the talks bounce around to different venues in different rounds for some good reasons on both sides. But that's obviously another thing that would be rather messy. At the moment, the Taliban is quite insistent that there not be any international facilitation. I frankly think that's because their expectation is that the U.S. in the person of Zalmay Khalilzad will be there to make sure that what they like to call the puppets in Kabul will dance to an American tune and make a deal. And so why introduce someone else into this mix that won't be as motivated as the U.S. to get a deal done? On the government side, they can't be asking for more foreign involvement in an Afghan affair than the Taliban is. And so at the moment, they are also resisting the idea of a neutral facilitator. Again, this is another reason why I think just the process alone will be exceedingly messy if and when the talks start. But, you know, there is some inching forward to the start of talks. I wouldn't be surprised to see them commence sometime maybe in August. I don't think by the end of this month is very likely, maybe August, maybe September. And then you get to the really hard part. I mean, to be clear, that would be a major, major breakthrough just to get the opening of intra-Afghan talks. But then you confront the really hard substantive questions, which include, first of all, what kind of deal are they even trying to make? What problems are they trying to solve? Are they going for some kind of narrow, thin agreement that just puts in place an interim government, a roadmap to future resolution of the core issues, or are they going for something more substantial? There are a lot of implications of the choice there. And then there is the very fundamental issue of, can they come to agreement on what the future nature of the state in Afghanistan will be? Will it continue to be a republic, which the Kabul side says is a red line for them, with democratic, more or less democratic elections as a system for choosing those in power? Will it be some kind of hybrid system that has more, let's say, theocratic elements to it, or something else? Neither side has really envisioned any particular compromises it's willing to make on those core issues, and I think that'll be a huge stumbling block.
So Seth, in your report, which I should have added is available on the council website, you anticipated a lot of these challenges, and you sort of laid out some, I think, very useful options, if you will, for moving the process along. And I'd be curious if you could kind of talk us through what is our leverage to keep things on track? What kind of tactics could we use to ensure that both sides negotiate in good faith and we have a reasonably acceptable outcome?
Sure. Paul, it's a good question. And obviously when we look at other negotiations, some successful, some failed, whether it's in El Salvador or Northern Ireland, or even the challenges in Colombia, even with a reduced FARC, this process is going to be extremely difficult. One of the concerns that I have is, and it's really a question, is to what degree are the Taliban serious about actually negotiating? How much of this is trying to read the political tea leaves in Washington? And it's not just the current administration, it would be also for a potential Biden administration on whether the U.S. really just wants to get out. And so, you know, how much does the Taliban really want to say whatever it needs to say so that it can get those U.S. forces out? If we're to get an agreement, I think part of the question has to be, how do we show some serious interest in supporting the Afghan government, even if it's without U.S. forces there? So one thing I think that would be helpful, and I know Ambassador Khalilzad has been involved in some of the financial discussions about a post-peace agreement, but I'd like to see the U.S. announce an agreement sooner rather than later with the Afghan government to provide longer-term economic, military and intelligence assistance to the government as an indication that however this goes, the U.S. has an interest in providing financial support to the government, to its security agencies, whether it's going to have combat forces there or not. And this level of commitment, I think, and would potentially reassure at least some leaders and some within the population that they're not about to be at least entirely abandoned. I think they're also, and Laurel mentioned this, and there's been great ICG work on this, is, you know, to what degree can the U.S. continue to push for a third-party mediator outside of ZAL? It seems to be an important part of past negotiations, to agree on a proximate timeline and structure for negotiations. I think the establishment of some kind of Friends of the Afghan peace process is important to bring in both donor, major donor communities, but also neighbors of Afghanistan. I think if there's anything that we have seen from failed agreements in the past, it's that when neighbors have very different views of the status of negotiations and peace in the country, it's certainly one way to tear those negotiations apart in the long run. So continuing to encourage and pull together those regional countries. And I'm going to say that includes Iran as well in this, because the Iranians have a stake in this. They were at Bonn at the beginning. They have provided assistance to the Taliban, particularly through the IRGC Quds Force. So they have a, you know, they do have a role, in my view, to play. I also think the U.S., in my view, should make it clear that, in particular, if Taliban leaders renege on their commitment to a peace deal, that the U.S. Would be willing in that sense to entertain keeping several thousand military, CIA, and other personnel in Afghanistan. Again, if Taliban intransigence is a major cause of collapsed or stalled intra-Afghan negotiations. And I also think if, you know, one of the things that's been detailed pretty significantly in the literature on successful settlements is credible threats to punish defectors from negotiations. So those countries or actors that defect from promises. And in this case, let's take the Taliban. If they begin to drag their feet on this, what are additional steps that the U.S. can take, whether it's with Pakistan, whether it's introducing, again, blacklisting of some Taliban leaders, whether it's whether there are other steps, ramping up targeting of Taliban leaders in Afghanistan, possibly even in Pakistan itself. What are steps the U.S. could indicate or signal now that it might be willing to take if the Taliban reneges? Because credible threats of punishment, again, appear to be a strong component, an indicator of successful peace settlements in the past. I think these are all things that the U.S. can do. Whether those steps alone will cause a peace settlement to be successful, you know, we'll have to see. But I think those at least slightly increase the odds.
And presumably this is a fairly extended, prolonged process we're talking about here, which is, you know, taking place against the backdrop of sort of diminishing interest and commitment from the U.S. I just wonder, frankly, how credible any threat of punishment or some kind of sanctions against the participants will be, given that everybody sees that we are, frankly, desperate or getting desperate to leave. And our interest in the country is evaporating, if it hasn't evaporated completely. So how do we balance those two realities, if you will?
Well, I think we have dug ourselves a bit of a hole on this one, which is by indicating an interest in withdrawing forces. If the administration between now and the elections continues to decrease that footprint from 8,600 downwards, I think that will give additional incentive to the Taliban to drag their feet on these, because I think the trend lines then look pretty straightforward. The U.S. will have gone from 14,000 to 8,600, then from 8,600 down to some other number. And I think, again, the leverage that the U.S. has then over the Taliban, particularly with the Taliban that has some state support, it continues to have some backing from Pakistan, including ISI, from the Russians, as we now know, although anybody that's followed Afghanistan for the last 4 years has seen Russian support at low levels, and then some Iranian support as well. So based on those factors, a U.S. that continues to decrease its presence, I think, undermines the credibility of any kind of threat that it can develop against the Taliban.
So I want to get back to the issue of how we protect our sort of core national security interests in Afghanistan with or without a deal. Before I get back to that, though, Laurel, you touched on how the deal, the agreement could be either a relatively modest arrangement or something much more comprehensive and inclusive. And I know there are a lot of folks who are worried about the civil society dimension of any agreement in Pakistan, particularly the rights of women. These are sort of hard-won rights over the last 20 years, and a lot of people worry that these will either be sacrificed or they will somehow be compromised fatally in the process, or if not afterwards. How do we ensure that, as I say, these hard-won won gains, particularly when it comes to women's rights, are secured in this deal?
We don't. I mean, I think we need to be very clear-eyed about the limitations of U.S. capability to influence and shape the outcome of this peace negotiation. It doesn't mean that there's zero influence. I mean, the Taliban see itself in a substantial portion, at least, of power in Afghanistan in the future, and they want continued international assistance to Afghanistan. They want their share of the gravy train that they claim Kabul wasted all these years. And they want the international legitimacy. And so to some extent, there is the potential there for tempering their policy positions as a result of that. So it's not no influence, but the idea that the US can set some kind of firm red lines on these questions, I think, is utterly fanciful. Moreover, there are plenty of people on the Kabul side of this negotiation who are going to be perfectly willing to sacrifice these things. Let's not have illusions that it's monolithically liberal and progressive on the Kabul side of the negotiating table. This is a government that just, you know, agreed as part of the overall political settlement of the elections crisis to make a serial human rights abuser, Dostum, a marshal. And I mean, the photographs of his coronation ceremony in the recent days are, you know, pretty revolting. Let's be clear about it. So I'm not suggesting that the U.S. should, you know, throw all these concerns about the status of women and minority rights under the bus. But on the other hand, is the U.S. actually going to keep troops in Afghanistan for this purpose? No. I mean, the issues for the U.S. in the end game of a negotiation in Afghanistan are going to center on what kinds of counterterrorism capabilities the U.S. will be able to have. What kinds of relationships would it need to have or capabilities keep in Afghanistan, and what kind of deal will enable that? And if not, how can it continue to protect its counterterrorism interests outside of Afghanistan?
Well, that's a good segue back to you, Seth. So how do we secure those interests and our obvious interest in preventing Afghanistan either becoming a sanctuary or being used as a platform for attacks on its neighbors? What do we do, frankly, if this the whole process collapses tomorrow? And how do we configure our forces? Do we just pull out regardless and work out some offshore way to secure our interests? What are the options here?
Well, I think answering that question first requires outlining what our interests are. And I think there's no question in my view that our interests have evolved, certainly since we put U.S. forces in 2001. We're in a very different situation today. The COVID crisis has created significant financial repercussions on the U.S. economy, as well as many other economies, including countries within Europe and Japan that have historically provided assistance to Afghanistan. The U.S., as its national defense strategy highlights, is also increasingly focused, and probably should be increasingly focused, on the Chinese and the Russians in particular, also Iran and North Korea. So, that means the U.S. has interests in balancing against the Russians in Europe, in the Middle East, Chinese in Asia, and other places. So Afghanistan sits in those in broader U.S. strategic interests, and they're not as high as they certainly were 20 years ago. But I do think the U.S. has interests remaining in Afghanistan, and I think one of them is preventing the country from again becoming a sanctuary for international terrorist groups. And I think the recent UN report on the Taliban-Al-Qaeda relationship was an interesting one, in part because it highlighted through both SIGINT intercepts that were provided, at least the intelligence was provided to UN representatives and some human sources, pretty hefty communications between the Taliban and Al-Qaeda, including this year in 2020, as the discussions progressed, pretty significant communications between Al-Qaeda and the Haqqani network as well. Activity of the Islamic State in Afghanistan, although they've been weakened in Nangarhar and weakened somewhat in Kunar, and the activity of other groups like Tariqi Taliban Pakistan, which was involved in the 2010 attack in Times Square, New York City, the Faisal Shahzad one, and then Lashkar-e-Taiba, among others, which was involved in the Mumbai attack. So a Taliban advance, which has continued somewhat over the last few years in rural areas, and the continuing presence of a number of terrorist organizations doesn't bode well for the future. Now, you know, we don't see the high levels of plotting against the U.S. that we saw in the early phases of this war, even in the 2009-10 period when the Najibullah Zazi plot in New York City was foiled. That went back to core Al-Qaeda in Pakistan. But we still see some concerns. I mean, the numbers that the UN was reporting were about 400 to 600 Al-Qaeda active in 12 Afghan provinces, about 2,200 or so Islamic State operatives in the country, and that can move back and forth. So there is still, I think, a U.S. interest in continuing to conduct operations against these groups, which means I don't see any reasonable way how the U.S. can pull all of its forces out and try to put them somewhere else in the neighborhood. I think it's going to have problems in doing that. Plus, when you pick up your combat forces, even your special operations forces, you lose some of your collection assets in those areas, the ability of intelligence units to co-locate at your bases. I think it would be a mistake, as long as we don't have a deal and we have terrorism concerns, to get out in mass and to keep some forces, whether it's at some combination of Bagram, Kandahar airfield, and even Kabul itself. And there are other concerns. I think there is a broader concern of a major humanitarian crisis with the U.S. pullout. And that goes beyond what Laurel just said earlier about, you know, issues related to civil and women's rights. I mean, we still see the number of Afghan refugees as being the second largest number in the world right now of refugees. You add an imploding country, you will do significant damage to IDPs and refugees. And there are also some broader concerns about, I think, U.S. credibility. I mean, I noted just talking to some officials after the February agreement with the Taliban from foreign governments that asked me, particularly from Asia, what's this mean if the U.S. leaves Afghanistan for our relationship with the U.S. and South Korea and Japan? But I think it raises a range of other issues as well if the U.S. were to pull out with no deal.
Okay, we can get to some of these other issues, hopefully, in the Q&A.
Can I just add one thing in response to what Seth just said? I mean, a couple of points, and we can pick up on them in the Q&A. I don't believe there's a long-term future for troops in Afghanistan, except under a very unlikely scenarios. If there is a peace deal, that will exclude having U.S. forces there, because the Taliban will not formally agree to the continued presence of foreign forces in Afghanistan. If there is not a peace deal in the current circumstances, then you're going to see continued deterioration of the security situation. And with the decline in U.S. force levels that is currently planned, you are going to see an increasingly weak and unstable government. If the U.S. withdraws, if U.S. tries to keep a small counterterrorism only focused presence in Afghanistan and declines to continue to support the Afghan government substantially in its counterinsurgency fight, that is an untenable situation. So I think it's unquestionable to me that outside of Afghanistan options need to be considered. When it comes to the impact on other alliances, I do not see NATO allies clamoring for the U.S. to stay in Afghanistan as a means of demonstrating U.S. credibility in keeping alliance commitments. And, you know, as for our treaty alliances in East Asia, there are way bigger concerns and stresses on those relationships than what the U.S. does in far-flung Afghanistan.
Okay, well, thank you for that, Laurel. So we're going to open it up for Q&A. I think most of you are now familiar with the procedure of Zoom to raise your blue hand in the queue. And please state your name and affiliation and try to keep your questions short if you can, please. I think we have Peter Galbraith first off here. Peter.
And sorry, this is rural Vermont. In other peace processes, you tend to have success because when you begin, you know where you're going to end up. So one of my questions is, what is the actual end state that one sees in Afghanistan? And also, how does it play out between the Tajiks and Hazaras, who might well want a more federal or decentralized state, and of course, with Abdullah being the negotiator, and the Pashtuns and Ashraf Ghani on the one hand. And the second thing about peace agreements is sides have to consider the alternative. And do the Taliban believe that if the U.S. withdraws, they could win militarily, take Kabul, and could they?
Okay, a lot of questions packed in there. Who wants to go first? You want to take a crack at that, Seth, and then I'll give Laurel a chance also to address some of those?
Sure. The end state, I think the what the end state looks like would probably be different for different people. I mean, in my view, the ideal end state would be, first, a recognition that the part of the reason this war continues for 20 years, the Taliban does have a support base in Afghanistan. They have a reasonable number of fighters. They have civilians that support the ideology, or at least are deeply opposed to the way the Afghan government has operated and governed. They're upset about corruption in the country. So that the Taliban has a support basis. So an end state then would have to incorporate the Taliban into a government so that it has a voice, it has some legitimacy, and that it has meaningful power, whether it's cabinet posts, officials at the provincial district level. And I think there is a legitimate question, though, about whether the Taliban, whether that's the end state the Taliban sees itself, whether it is willing to compromise and participate in some kind of a government in Afghanistan the way, say, the FMLN cooperated. They, as part of a peace deal in El Salvador, they became a major political party and actually ended up running the country through elections. So there's certainly an agreement. There certainly is a question about whether the Taliban views that end state, or at least the way to get there, as a similar one to the way the Afghan does. On the alternatives, I mean, my own view and is that if the U.S. were to withdraw all of its forces from Afghanistan, and the Europeans were to do the same, you're shifting the balance of power significantly in favor of a Taliban that continues to have its sanctuary in Pakistan, that continues to get support from at least three notable states in the broader region. How quickly it could take Kabul would be a cause of some debate. I have no doubt that at some point in the next few years, the Taliban would take Kabul. You know, they'll have a harder time in some areas where there'll be local Hazara resistance or Tajik or Uzbek resistance, including some areas up in the north. But I would assess that the Taliban would overthrow the government in Kabul with a complete U.S. departure. And I just, one other comment in response to Laurel's comments earlier. I mean, I think one of the things that the U.S. military experience in Syria has shown us is that even in a country with an active war, the U.S. has been able to keep small numbers of forces, particularly special operations forces in that country, and continue to conduct attacks, including killing the head of the Islamic State, even in the midst of a war. And that's a case where it doesn't even have any kind of relationship with the government as well. So I think there are
options. You're going to hold Bagram in those circumstances?
Well, you can put forces at a lot of different places, as we've seen in the Syria context.
Okay. Anything to add there, Laurel?
Yeah, I mean, a few things. I suspect that the Taliban have some doubts themselves about their ability to rapidly take over the country militarily. They don't say that outright, but they do say that they are concerned about a Syria-like scenario in Afghanistan if the U.S. withdraws without a peace agreement in place. And so I think at least the more politically minded, relatively savvier elements of the Taliban recognize the kind of chaos that could ensue. And that would be not just not some kind of cakewalk to the gates of Kabul for them. As they're currently situated, they don't have the manpower and the capabilities to both defeat the Afghan security forces and to take and hold all the city of Kabul is vastly larger and more sprawling and a more complex place than when they took it the first time. And in order for them to roll into and hold Kabul, there would have to be a lot of side switching that occurs, and there would have to be a lot of patchwork deal making that occurs among Afghans. But just Taliban as it is today, is not postured to sweep through the country. What you could easily have is a protracted and intensified civil war as they struggle to take Kabul and as others struggle to repel them. On the point about what the end state is, I think one of the real problems in the peace process is there has been a lack of articulation or even thinking about what the end state looks like to different constituencies on the different sides. I don't think the Taliban has gone through the process of internally developing consensus on a detailed end state, and other than some fairly simplistic and general ideas, and that's going to be an impediment for them in negotiating quickly. On the Afghan government side, you have some who clearly believe that the end state should be basically what it is now, with some tweaks and some jobs for Taliban incorporated into the existing system. You have others on the Kabul side who recognize that's completely implausible as anything that the Taliban would agree to or would feel it has to agree to given its leverage. But they haven't figured out what the alternative, what the fallbacks of that could be. I wrote a long report when I was at RAND outlining and actually written in the form of a peace agreement of what an Afghan peace agreement might look like, with some alternatives to take, an outsider's stab at trying to depict what the end state might look like. I hope to at least inspire others to do something similar from within Afghanistan, and there's really been very little effort along those lines yet, even though there are some groups of Afghans that are trying to develop some ideas. But it's an early stage, and it's a reason why the peace process, if it gets going, will take a long time.
Okay, so next up we have Ambassador James Dobbins. Hi, Jim. Please unmute.
Hi, just a comment. I agree with everything that Seth and Laurel said, not surprisingly. It strikes me that the current status quo as regards to negotiation is rather, is quite tolerable from the US standpoint. The Taliban has agreed to stop targeting Americans. They've also agreed to let the Americans continue to fight on behalf of the Afghans. We've lost no soldiers, no casualties since the peace agreement was signed. There has been some rise. It's not clear how much the, whether there's been a rise in violence, Afghan on Afghan, or whether it's normal or even slightly diminished. It is true that there hasn't been a single attack on a provincial capital, whereas these were fairly frequent in previous years. And there's only been one attack on a district capital. I'm not saying that this situation can be sustained forever, but it strikes me that from a standpoint of the battlefield, the U.S. isn't under any pressure. If it's under pressures, it's a purely domestic pressure, and the domestic pressure will diminish if we continue to suffer no casualties.
Seth, do you want to comment on that?
Jim's right in the sense that the current status quo, we've seen very limited, if any, targeting of U.S. forces. The targeting has been Afghan National Army police, NDS facilities. Obviously, there are other organizations, including the Islamic State, that have conducted attacks in Afghanistan. But in that sense, it's been an ideal situation for the U.S. and the targeting of U.S. forces. The big question, which Jim alludes to, is if this momentum, at least to begin to start negotiations, falters, or if it falters, then what happens? Then the Taliban loses its incentives to do that. And so then you may see a return to targeting forces in Afghanistan. But what this does indicate to me is that supporting momentum towards getting these intra-Afghan negotiations actually has a secondary impact, which is it's an impact that is, you know, decreased the threat for the moment anyway to the U.S., its forces, its embassies. We haven't seen the embassy targeted either. And I think that means that we should stick for now with pushing for negotiations, because they're having several positive impacts, even if we don't see success yet at the negotiating table.
So, you know, Jim alluded to the fact that, you know, the objective facts on the ground are tolerable from a U.S. standpoint, but is that relevant to where the U.S. public is at the moment? I just wonder whether we've reached a point where it almost doesn't matter whether we're losing folks on the battlefield, that we just want out, and that's where the winds are blowing here. Can you say anything about current public opinion polls in the U.S. about withdrawal, where things stand there?
Yeah, I mean, when you ask the question, then the response is we should get out of Afghanistan. And the numbers are even higher among veterans along those lines than they are among the general population, you know, which presumably means people who are paying relatively more attention to it. But is this a major issue? No. I mean, the people are not on the streets clamoring for the U.S. to get out of Afghanistan. This is not, I don't see public opinion as driving an imperative to get out of Afghanistan, even if you can, when asked, you can say, yes, this is an unpopular war at this point. I think, you know, I agree with Seth that the urgency is to get the talks started for the reasons he outlined, is that when you have it dragging on, when you have these kinds of delays, you lose momentum, you lose opportunity, and once you get the talks started, you may have new opportunities on the horizon. I think for the U.S. to have an urgency to quickly concluding the talks in some way that might be kind of quick and dirty is entirely driven by electoral politics and not by popular sentiment or what's good for a peace process or what's good even for Afghanistan, much less for U.S. interests. And so, you know, I have concerns about, at least, you know, in recent months, the U.S. side suggesting that there was going to be a deal before November, which hopefully they now have internalized the complete implausibility of that.
Paul, if I can just add two quick comments to Laurel's, and I agree with her. One is just to highlight, you know, that people have often equated the U.S. departure from Afghanistan with the Vietnam years. And I think there is no question right now that the push to get out of Vietnam, we don't see anything like that with Afghanistan. Demonstrations in the streets, major election issue. We don't see that kind of public push to get U.S. forces out of Afghanistan that we have seen in some instances in the past. The other, it's just mindful of noting, even within the president's own party, you know, several very senior senators, for example, including Lindsey Graham, Mitch McConnell, both support keeping U.S. forces for the moment in Afghanistan. So on the Hill front, you know, there's a mixed bag on views on Afghanistan. But from the president's own party, some of his most ardent supporters right now, at least with power on the Hill, do not support a precipitous withdrawal. So I think that does complicate the domestic picture a little bit.
Okay, next up, Steve Biddle. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Paul. Question first for Laurel, but I'll also be interested in Seth's view on what we know or can know about the Taliban's motives at this point. So they incurred a huge risk of factionalism by being willing to enter into these talks and enter into this process at all. And they've taken real casualties in fights with the Islamic State in Afghanistan, in part because of their apparent willingness to talk to the great Satan. I'd always assumed that what was going on was, as Laurel pointed out, they're afraid of a serious scenario. They think it might take a long time to unfold and the country will collapse in the meantime, and therefore they're interested in pursuing a compromise settlement that could end the war sooner. And yet their behavior, right, in the last year has looked like they're driving a really, last few months, has looked like they're driving a really hard bargain. They may be prepared to just fight this out and see if they can win outright. I'm beginning to wonder, does their behavior in the last few months, should their behavior in the last few months change our perception of what they're after, what their motives are, what their best alternative to negotiated agreement might look like? Should we be changing our view of what they're after in light of what we've seen recently?
Thanks. It's a good question. Personally, I don't think so. I mean, I think you outlined their motivations fairly well. I think they are serious about negotiating to test the proposition that they can achieve their objectives through the negotiation, like anyone else. They're no less serious about the negotiating process than the Kabul side. In fact, I'd say they're more serious about the negotiating process than some on the Kabul side, because the negotiating process has been going pretty well for them. And the Taliban, both in negotiations and in their performance on the battlefield, has learned the lesson that stubborn consistency works for them. Stubborn consistency helps them maintain their sufficient internal cohesion, and it has led to gains for them, both on the battlefield in terms of accreting some international legitimacy, and in terms of negotiating now with the US and potentially in the future with the Taliban. What they haven't done yet is to sort of socialize within the movement ideas about what compromise could look like. So they haven't taken a lot of risk of factionalization in what they've done so far. They've taken some, but they prepared for this over many years. I mean, it's been quite some years ago now that they began the process of socializing within the movement the idea of negotiating. And they had some, and they had an actual process of doing that. And they mitigated the risk of factionalization by doing that. I don't believe they've gone so far as to, as I said, socialize ideas about what compromise could look like. So it's going to be much harder for them in the negotiations to be able to both maintain their cohesion and actually agree to compromises, which is why the negotiations might fail. But that doesn't mean they're not serious about trying to achieve their objectives through the negotiation. Their alternative to the negotiation is continuing to fight the war. That, you know, they've shown they're not going away. That however long the U.S. is prepared to stay in Afghanistan, they will be there longer. And that they've been able to manage their difficult relations with Pakistan in the sort of the push and pull of that relationship in a way that has enabled them to maintain enough support to be able to continue the fight and to diversify their sources of support. So, you know, I don't think they're in a ready, I mean, it's interesting in the last few months, particularly after last September, how they stuck with the peace process even after last September. Trump, you know, abruptly threw it off the rails by suggesting they were invited to Camp David and then, you know, canceling the talks altogether. They took a very moderated approach to responding to that and said, well, we're still ready whenever you're ready. When the prisoner exchange issue heated up, again, they are being stubborn and they are insisting on what they believed they were promised in the U.S.-Taliban negotiations, which I think they were promised, right, not justifying it. I'm just saying they're sticking with what they believe the agreement was, and they're stubbornly sticking to it, is showing that, you know, eventually the others bend to that. But at the same time, they've said, as soon as this issue is resolved, we're ready to start talks within a week. And so I think the fact that they have stuck with a process that has had the kinds of ups and downs that it's had over the year, looking at it from their perspective, shows a seriousness of willingness to give this a shot, because the alternatives, it's more desirable to them to negotiate their way into power than it is to try to fight their way into power.
Anything you want to add there?
So, yeah, just briefly, Steve, on your point about the Taliban's willingness to take casualties against the Islamic State, I actually think this was in a sense, it was a win-win for them to take steps like that, because one is the Islamic State is an enemy, and from their first indications that the Islamic State was talking to the Oruksai TTP, which had defected and pledged allegiance to Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, they've been an enemy of the Taliban since the beginning. So I think it is normal, and one would expect that the Taliban would conduct operations both against the Afghan government and the U.S. as well as against other potential adversaries on the ground. So and it actually probably has some domestic support as well to target the Islamic State, which is often viewed as a foreign organization. So I don't think there are huge costs in doing that. The other thing, just to add to Laurel's, is, you know, this is at least my understanding now, based on some of the declassified assessments of the Viet Cong strategy in Vietnam, this is not the strategy that the Viet Cong established with Kissinger and with the U.S., which was basically just to say anything and then in private to recognize as soon as the U.S. were to leave, they were going to do exactly what they wanted to do, nothing to do necessarily with what they promised during the Paris Peace Accords. So the Taliban has not adopted that approach, which does raise questions about to what degree they are concerned if they were to adopt a Viet Cong-style approach to the negotiations, they would risk isolating some of their constituents, either civilians or more broadly militant groups, some of the Haqqanis, certainly some of the Taliban fighters that have been fighting for two decades, whether they believe that a Viet Cong style agreement, basically saying anything to get an agreement to get the US out, would have some short-term costs. And that actually is an interesting question, because if that's the case, that does say something interesting about Taliban's concern about fracturing with a peace agreement of organizations and individuals that are fighting with it at the moment.
Okay, we're running out of time. We have time, for one more question. I saw Karen Karnicki from the Rockefeller Brothers Fund, I believe. Were you wanting to ask a question, Karen?
Yes, hi. Thank you, Paul. And thank you, Seth and Laurel, for this really interesting conversation. The question I'm wondering about is, to what extent do you think that the U.S. government in particular may be willing to push for a bit more of a comprehensive approach around peace in terms of transitional justice efforts or looking at within the negotiations around addressing some of the social and economic factors that may be driving or underlying the violence that we're seeing in Afghanistan. And I'm thinking primarily of the Colombian process and how all of that played a role into getting the agreement that was reached. And what do you think the implications of pushing for these types of elements would be in the negotiations? Thanks.
How about you take that, Laurel?
Sure. I don't think the U.S. will push for that. I think the U.S. is doing exactly the opposite at the moment. I mean, it is hard in any peace process to figure out what's the balance to strike between having a comprehensive enough agreement that you really resolve some core issues or at least, create a basis for resolving those issues in the future and not overcomplicating the agreement in a way that makes the negotiations very difficult and even more protracted. I would advocate something in a middle ground that is not a flimsy agreement, but is nothing like the Colombia agreement in its scope and complexity. I think, unfortunately, the U.S. currently is pushing for a very short-termist approach, trying to get in place something that looks very much like the Bonn Agreement of 2001, which I don't believe is really, I don't think the circumstances of 2001 analogize to 2020, and I think that would be a very fragile and dangerous kind of agreement to put in place now. But I think the U.S. is looking for less, not more. And the Afghans themselves, I believe, are unsettled on this question. I don't have high hopes for transitional justice being addressed in any effective way when you consider that even without adding the Taliban into the mix, Afghanistan has not been able to get anywhere close to addressing those kinds of issues in the last 20 years. Adding the Taliban into the equation isn't going to make it easier. It's only going to make it harder and more complex. So I think the most you can do is think about some kind of mechanisms you could begin to seed in Afghanistan to eventually deal with those issues, but without any expectation of near-term results, unfortunately.
I'm going to squeeze one last question in and to you, Seth. So we haven't really touched on the role of external powers. And I wonder whether, in very quickly, you could just give us some sense of how much of they will play a constructive role, how we can leverage them in a constructive way, or whether we should more or less expect that they really won't be playing much of a role here and will be sidelined. Can you just give us a quick sense?
Yeah, and by Paul, you mean external powers. You're talking about states in particular?
Yes.
I think the history of Afghanistan is pretty straightforward on this one, that the role of external powers are going to be absolutely essential to either a successful deal being implemented and then followed through and then peace coming to Afghanistan, or the continuation of war in various forms. I mean, one of the challenges, we've got a lot of conflict dyads here. We've got, we've got some Iranian support and Russian support and Pakistan support for the Taliban. We've got the US and the Europeans. We've got financial discussions between the Central Asian countries and Afghanistan, which is what Zal's been, who's in Tashkent for. We've got the India-Pakistan dimension to this fight, which will continue in part because there are groups in Afghanistan that that are targeting the Indians, including Lashkar-e-Taiba and Jaish-e-Mohammed. And then we've got the Chinese next door who have also been interested in development projects in Afghanistan. So I think on...
Looks like we may have lost Seth in mid-century.
Issues from energy to important dimension from any of it.
Okay, I can't say I've heard anything today that's improved my sense of optimism about the prospects for peace in Afghanistan. I'm gonna ask both of you to give us your kind of numeric probability for a successful agreement. Where would you rate the likelihood of success in numeric terms now, very quickly?
Likelihood of success in numeric terms.
Yeah.
I'll go first. You know, it's well under 50%. You know, if you want my estimate of what the most likely scenario is in Afghanistan over the next couple of years, it's that the peace process fails to produce a result, the U.S. withdraws anyway, the civil war intensifies in Afghanistan, the U.S. pivots to a strategy of trying to contain the problems of Afghanistan within Afghanistan, it renews its efforts to work in closer collaboration with Pakistan as its way of dealing with its counterterrorism concerns, supplemented by over-the-horizon approaches. And it basically tries to align more with the regional powers' approach to Afghanistan than with the existing and deteriorating Afghan government itself. That's not to say that I think it's not possible for the better scenarios to occur. I mean, there is no peace process that of any consequence that looks likely and has a high probability of success at the outset. And it will look like failure until the day it succeeds, if it ever does. But if you wanted my prudent planning estimate of what is likely to happen, it's that darker scenario that I just outlined, and a very, realistic, pragmatic, if you will, U.S. approach to Afghanistan that emerges as a result.
So Seth, Laurel's under 50%. Where are you?
I am well under 50% for an agreement that brings the Taliban and the Afghan government into a new joint government that gives some power and legitimacy to both sides and their constituencies. I'm at a higher percentage, probably even over 50% maybe, for a sort of a fig leaf agreement which allows the U.S. to withdraw its forces that probably looks closer to the Paris Peace Accords than it does to what we've just outlined.
Okay, with that, we are well over time, and I apologize for those for that. I want to thank you both, Seth and Laurel, for being with us today. This has been a terrific, if depressing, conversation. But hope springs eternal, and who knows, we may be pleasantly surprised. But on what I've heard today, I can't say that I'm any more optimistic. So again, thank you both, and thank you everybody on the line.
Thanks, Paul. Thanks, Seth.
Thanks, Paul. Thanks, Laura.